So my name's John Sheehan, and I'm from the Windows Group. And today, we're going to be talking about Project Centennial. How many of you, this is your first talk on Project Centennial. How many of you have been to any of the previous ones? Sorry, so it's a lot of people, this is sort of your first introduction. Great. So before I get started about talking about Project Centennial, I just want to point out that this is one of those things where a very small group of people inside of Microsoft in a pretty limited period of time went and built a ton of great tech. And they're all sitting here today, and I would just love if you guys could give them a round of applause, please. Thanks. Okay, so let's begin. So Project Centennial, why did we do it? It turns out that there are 16 million Win32 or .NET apps in the world right now. And when we built the universal platform, we kind of left them behind. And that was dumb. Right? I mean, it really was. And so we decided we really needed to fix that. And so we took a small group of people and said, what would it mean if we wanted to take these 60 million apps and make them able to become universal apps? And even better, what if we wanted to take those apps and then allow the developers to preserve their code investment, but migrate to be a full universal Windows app so you could actually run on Xbox, on HoloLens, on any of those things? And so, you know, we went off and thought about it, and what we came up with is Project Centennial. Now, in this talk, I'm going to basically take you through the process of taking your app from what you have now and converting it and making it a Centennial app and then getting it all the way to being a UWP. And I have Payman here who's going to basically do my demos for me and show you all the code and what it takes to do it. But before I begin, I'm just going to give you a very high-level overview of what the process looks like. So the very first thing you're going to do when you want to take your app and convert it to Universal Windows is you're going to run it through what we call the Desktop App Converter. And what the Desktop App Converter does is it takes your existing installer, it actually runs the installer, and it figures out what your app was trying to do to the system, and it repackages it as an AppX. And so when you're done with this first stage, you'll actually end up having an AppX. Then you'll go and test it and make sure that it works. Now, we're not promising that all of the code that you have will just work. We do have a lot of experience now. We've been working on this for a little while. And we find that most apps just work fine. Some apps might need some small changes. And so we'll talk a little bit about what those changes might be. And once you do that, and you can go ahead and add features, new things, and when you're done, you'll actually be able to publish your app to either the Windows Store, or if you want to, you can deploy it through whatever other means you wish. And if you saw in, I'm not sure if we showed it, I think we showed it in the keynote actually, we've now added features where we have automatically enabled sideloading, and in this next release, in the anniversary release, we're going to enable you so you can just double click on the AppX and it will just install. See, Ender, you were right. The double click has been like one of the most popular things we've released. So, all right, so let's begin. So first you have your Win32 app, right? This is the or.NET, but your desktop app. And this is the app that you spent many years building. You've probably already made lots of money on. You have a big customer base. And there's so much investment in that app that attempting to just go and rewrite it is, you know, silly. And so what we do is we're going to say, OK, start here, and then go through the conversion process. And the converter is going to figure out what it takes for your app to be deployed through our AppX technology. And you get a lot of benefit out of that, right? So first and foremost, you get the easy install. So an AppX app, like the install is very, very fast. It's very highly reliable, both on the installation side and also on the uninstallation side. And it means you never have to write an installer ever again. And then, once you start doing that, at that point, you're already ready to be able to take it either to the store or to wherever else you want to sell it from. And this is all just using your existing code. And so, rather than have me talk about it, I'm actually going to have Payman show you what it looks like. So, you ready? So, we are 8. So, I want to point out that my PMs were very nice and that they were worried that something might go wrong up here. So they actually built me an entire fake converter. It looked just like this when you ran it. You got feedback. It looked great, but it was actually fake. It didn't really do it. And so rather than do that, we decided let's do it for real. And not only do that, let's do it with a real app. So we're taking Evernote here, and we're running it through the process right on stage. And so it's going to take a few minutes, because if you've ever seen Evernote's installer takes a bit of time. And so let me explain what's happening right now. Payman kicked off a PowerShell script that we told it, here is the Evernote installer. And when you're done, I want you to put the output here. And if you saw, I don't know if you saw it quickly, but there's a whole bunch of parameters there. It's basically about telling it how to automatically install, because the converter only works today with a silent installer. So if your installer requires you to click next, done, the current version of the converter won't work. You give it basically a command line that says, here's how to silently install my app. And then what the converter does is it spins up a Docker container. So how many of you know Docker containers? Some of you. It's basically like a VM, but it's not a VM. Okay, it's actually just another user mode session of Windows that's completely isolated from the session you're running in. And inside of that Docker container, we run the install. This means that we're completely install technology agnostic. You don't have to be MSI, you can be a random setup.exe. It could be a bat file that just copies stuff and does reg commands. Like, we don't care. And so we're just running your installer in that Docker container. And what's happening in that container is it's capturing all the changes to the system. So anything that your installer is writing to the file system, we catch it. Anything it's writing to the registry, we catch it. And so when we're done, we actually know what changes your installer made to the system. At that point, we can then go and analyze it. We can take all the files, we can bring them over, we can take all the registry values, we can go and look at them, and we can figure out things like, did it put a shortcut on the start menu? If it did, we will generate you a tile. If it went and registered for a bunch of file type associations, we will go and generate an APEX manifest that registers for those file type associations. And whatever other changes it made to the system that we need to know about, we automatically detect all of that, and we go ahead and we generate everything for you. So when you're done, and it worked, So when you're done, you end up with a real APEX, and it's something you can, we're copying out of the VM now?
Yep.
Okay. So it's something you can copy to your desktop, and you can double click on, and it will be installed. Is it going? Oh, sorry, it needs to be signed first. Oh, that's one thing. Yes, you can sideload applications, but they still need to be signed. The signature for APEX is very, very important. It's how we can preserve trust on the system. And so what we don't want to do is have you go and get something that claims it's Microsoft Office, for example. You double click on it, install it, and it turns out that it's actually some other random thing. And so the package needs to be signed, and it needs to be signed by a cert that's trusted for code execution, and that chains up to a trusted root. The most famous trusted root is probably VeriSign, but it doesn't have to be VeriSign. It's really any trusted root that you have, including a lot of enterprises have their own trusted roots, and it can be signed with that cert as well. So here we see that Payman's actually launched Evernote, and this is the one he just converted. And I promise you that's true because I didn't let them cheat. And here you go. So we've converted Evernote. We've launched it, and it's installed and registered through APEX, and it's actually running. Nice job. And by the way, like every time I've done this talk, there are like 10,000 questions. So I'm going to try to go a little bit quickly because I'm going to try to leave as much time as I can for them. And also, by the way, if you want to try this on your apps, bring your installer to the third floor. We have a booth up there where you can bring your installers and run them. And it will go ahead and we'll convert it for you and see if your app works. So I highly recommend you check that out. One other note about the converter, you don't actually have to use it. It doesn't matter whether you use the converter or not, it's just a convenience. If you're using Install Shield or you're using Wix, both of those technologies, they've already done the work, so they can take the definitions that they have for defining apps and spit out Centennial AppXs directly. So that means if you already have those things in, as part of your build system, you shouldn't even have to do any of this work. You should be able to go ahead and just update your version to the latest one so that you can get this new tech, and it can just start spitting out your Centennial apps right out of your build system. Okay, so, there we go. And we're back. So I talked a bit about how the converter worked, but what actually happened when he double-clicked on the AppX and hit install? Well, for any of you that understand how UWAs are installed, it'll make a lot of sense. We have a deployment stack in Windows that the file format is AppX. What we did was we actually generated a real AppX, and basically, it's an AppX, and it is a UWA, but it takes advantage of a couple of new extension points that we've added to Windows. And those extension points are basically the things that will activate your code and run it just like it would have been run if it was installed with MSI. And so the deployment stack, it basically takes the AppX, it lays it out on disk just like your installer would have, and then it goes through the registration process. And so at that point, we now have it registered on disk and ready to go. There's one other thing that it does at runtime, which is when you launch that app, we create what we call a desktop app container. And if you understand what an app container is, you're probably thinking, oh, crap. Because you're thinking what we're probably going to do is like sandbox your app so it can't do anything to the system and blah, blah, blah. And no, we're actually not doing that. The desktop app container really just has two purposes. The first purpose is to make your code still work. All right? So when you run your MSI install, it basically just vomits stuff all over the system. Right? It throws stuff in the registry, it throws stuff in system 32. Has anyone ever heard the term DLL hell? It's because your installer just like went and replaced stuff that was in system 32. It's just basically awful. Like the things it does to your system is just awful. And that's why people are usually afraid to run your MSI, because they're always worried, my system's working right now. What happens after I run your installer? Will it work anymore? And so we obviously don't like that. We don't think that that's a good experience for users. And we actually think that gets in the way of you making money, right? If you want people to use your app and they're afraid to install it, like, that means you're going to lose some percentage of your users just because of that fear. Well, we don't have that problem with Centennial, because when your app installer says, hey, I'm going to jam some stuff into System 32, and I'm just going to go and jam stuff in the registry, we capture all that, and then we put it separately, and we store it separately in your package. But when your app runs, your code expects those files to be in System 32 or maybe in common files or wherever, and they expect all that stuff to be just chucked into the registry wherever your installer happened to put it. And so what we didn't want you to have to do was rewrite all of your code, right? I mean, that would be a pretty poor story where we say, hey, we did this conversion for you, you're welcome. Now just go rewrite all your code and it'll work great. So instead, what we did was we went off and we're leveraging some kernel filters that we have, both in the file system and for the registry. And basically, we lie to your app, right? Your app says, hey, that file I jammed into System 32, it's there, right? And we say, yep, totally, it's there. There you go. And so when you call create file for that path, under the covers, we redirect it to your install location. But you don't have to change your code. And this means that code that you wrote that runs correctly on Win 7, it should continue to run correctly under Centennial. And basically what we're doing is we're just starting to automatically enforce the best practices that we already had. Yes, we told you, hey, you can put things in System 32, but it was always a dumb idea. Right? It was never a good idea to do it, but we told you you could. We also said, you can go edit the registry. Right? Just like every time you go into MSDN and you do a search for some problem, and it says, there's a registry key to fix that, and then there's this big disclaimer. Right? It says, editing your registry, your system may never boot again, blah, 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 blah. Anyway, here's how to edit your registry to go do this. Right? So we figured maybe we should stop doing that, and maybe we should give you a better way where you won't accidentally ruin the system. And so that's the real point of these filters. It's the main purpose of them is to preserve your code so you don't have to go rewrite it. If you want to go change your code, you're more than welcome to. But it's not something that's necessary just to use Centennial and just to get into the store. The other purpose of it, I said that's the main purpose. There is a secondary purpose. And the secondary purpose is uninstall. So it turns out that building a safe uninstaller is basically impossible, right? We built MSI, you're welcome, I guess, sorry. And MSI isn't able to track all the resources on the system. It just can't. So every time you hit uninstall, you should probably say a short prayer and then hit the uninstall button because it may or may not work. And so what we wanted to do is make sure that, yes, your existing code expects the world to look a certain way. Yes, there's a new way that the world should look like, but we'll bridge it for you. And so the second thing that it does is it basically says, when you're writing data into your app data folder, we're saying, okay, great, that's the common app data folder, which, by the way, is just a big cesspool of random stuff all thrown together. We redirect it to your own private app data folder. So we do that for you automatically. And you'll see in a few slides why there are other benefits to that. But by doing that, and by the way, in modifications you make to the registry, we redirect to your own special Hive that's just there for your app. And we basically store those separately as well. So that means when you hit uninstall in a Centennial app, for any of the stuff that was in app data or that was jammed in the registry, we can actually remove all of that. So what that means is we can actually clean up, and you don't have to worry about trying to uninstall a Centennial app. It does one other really nice thing. How many of you have noticed on day one when you buy a brand new computer, it's really fast? It boots fast, it logs in fast, it's really fast. And then over time, it kind of just gets a little bit slower and a little bit slower. A big part of that, especially the boot time, is what some people refer to it as registry bloat, right? Which is every time you install an app, it starts copying stuff into your registry hives. Over time, those things grow and grow and grow. Every time we boot your machine, we have to take HKLM and we basically have to map it into PagePool and get it ready. And then when you log in, we have to take your own private hive for your profile, and there's two of them, but we have to load those. And what happens is they just keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger. And more COM objects just get registered in your registry. And they just keep getting larger and larger. And so what ends up happening is your system is obviously going to slow down because we have to do way more I/O to boot the system and also to find COM objects and stuff before we can actually run it. The nice thing about Centennial is that's no longer true. So by the way, does anyone have any idea, I assume at least some of you are Visual Studio users. How many of you have installed the Ultimate Uber, whatever, has everything edition? Guess how many registry items it put in there. Can anyone have a guess? Come on, someone yell out a guess. Someone said 70,000, someone said what?
1 million.
Actually, 1 million is way closer than 70,000. It's 750,000, give or take. Yeah, it's like 30 megs of 30 megs of like D words and strings. It's insane. And that means that even if you're not gonna use Visual Studio right now, every time you boot your device, we gotta load up all those 30 megs of stuff and get it into PagePool, which means the amount of free PagePool you have is smaller. It's crazy. And so with Centennial apps, that's not true. Now, if you launch a Centennial app, then yes, then we have to map the values in so that the app will continue to work. But if you're not running the app, none of that stuff has to be paged in. And so like, those are the key values that we have for the runtime. Make sense? All right. So great. What did you get so far? You have something that you can is repackaged. You get to throw away your installer code. You're welcome this time. But you know, what else can it do, right? What other value did you get? It turns out that just by doing this, your app already has what we call identity. So every UWA has a unique identity that's tied all the way back to the digital signature of the app. Just by running this conversion process and signing it, you now got one. And by having that, it means that there's a whole bunch of APIs that you can now call just from your desktop code. So you can do things like live tiles and all that kind of stuff. And it also means that you can now start writing UWP code. And that's what we're going to start talking about now. Because, by the way, and I like to tell people this, we call Centennial a bridge for a reason. It's a bridge to get your app and then keep your investments, but become a full UWP, right? Like, who wouldn't want to be able to run on HoloLens if they wanted, or Xbox, or even IoT, right? Who wouldn't want their code to be able to run on all these different devices? Well, that's what the Centennial bridge is for. And I like to tell people is, like, step one is not the end of the bridge. It's not even the middle of the bridge. And it's pretty stupid to get on a bridge and then stop, right? You get on a bridge because you want to go somewhere. Like, we're going to show you how to get all the way to become a UWP. So the very next thing you can do that we'll talk about is just calling UWP APIs from your app. So I mentioned live tile, stuff like that. I thought we had a demo then. No. By the way, not their fault. I reordered the entire deck like 20 minutes ago. it's fun that way. It keeps me on my toes. All right. So one other thing you can do is, like, not only can you call WinRT APIs from your desktop code, you can also start taking advantage of things that actually require app container code to run. Like, a great example is background tasks. One of the things about Win32 apps is they're completely unmanaged. Like, they're able to just completely and utterly destroy your battery, which is powerful, by the way. It really is. Like, if you can have unfettered access in the background, you can do some really cool things. And for UWP, we really do want you to be able to do that if necessary. But how many times have you been, like, using your computer and it gets slow and the battery starts dying and you go look and some random desktop app that you weren't currently using and wasn't doing anything useful for you, it just had a CPU pegged? Why? Yeah, because it could, right? And so we really can't resource manage them. And so what we're doing is allowing you to start taking that background code and start moving it into background tasks. And it lets you do some pretty powerful things, like take advantage of all the triggers that happen in the UWP platform. And it also lets you run in what we call connected standby. Right? So when you push the power button on, let's say, a Surface Pro, the screen goes off. All of the Win32 apps stop running. It's for the Win32 app, it's basically no different than sleep. But for your Win32 app, you might still want to be able to do some stuff. And the way you can do it is by using a background task. All right. Now we have a demo. Go into there. Okay, so what we basically have here is we have just a regular classic Windows app, and we're gonna, and this is basically the code it takes to do a live tile. So this is exactly the same code, by the way, that you would write if you were building a UWP. So it's not that we built a parallel Win32 live tile API surface that's kind of like a mirror of what would normally happen. This is just your real code. And so if you look here, you can go in and see that this app, which is just a Win32 app, has a live tile. You can go in and update it, and it works just like you would expect. So this is like a really simple thing you can do to start to make your apps feel more alive. We've been working with developers right now, and we just got some data recently. One of our partners, they had an app. It was already UWP. They didn't have a live tile, and it's actually a pretty popular app. And so recently, they put a live tile in, and the amount of user engagement they had went up by 20%. I believe the phrase that I heard was, that is unheard of, right? They struggled to get 2% more, you know, user interactivity with their apps. All they did was add a live tile. It just prodded the user and let the user know, hey, there's things going on, and it brought the users back into their apps. So even with something as simple as this, it can be a big win for your apps. So let me go back now. Okay. So now you've got your basic Centennial app. You've converted it. You've called a few APIs, but it's still basically just your desktop app. The next things you can start doing is really start making it integrate with the system the same way that UWAs do. So for example, I was actually just talking to someone right before this talk, and they said, hey, we'd really like to be able to do the launch URI for results thing, but we're a desktop app. We can't do that. And I assumed Centennial couldn't help us, and I said, oh, no, absolutely, you can. Now that you're a Centennial app, you can participate in every single solitary contract that we have. You want to work in the file picker? Great, go write the file picker code. The one key thing is that rather than writing MFC, which I'm sure you're really psyched about, instead you end up writing that in XAML. So what you do is you end up with a second project in Visual Studio. You have the project for your regular desktop code. You start building projects for your other stuff. So you still have one app. It's a single AppX. It has a desktop EXE inside of it, but it also has, now you'll also start having XAML EXEs inside of it. Yes, they will run inside the app container. That's okay. We'll show you why in a minute. But also, they can do absolutely everything that the UWP can do. But it does mean one interesting thing, which is now, as a Centennial app, that also has all of these new background tasks and everything inside of it, you actually end up with at least two processes, right? You have the one process, which is running in desktop. It's your existing, MFC or WPF app. And then secondly, you have either the background task or the file picker UI. And so you end up in this world where you now have two separate processes, but you still probably want them to, A, you want them to be able to talk to each other, and B, you want to make sure that they can launch each other, right? So if you have some code that's running in a background task, it may want to communicate with the desktop app process that's running, or vice versa. So we actually have you covered on that. And I clicked. There we go. So basically, we allow activation in both directions, right? So your app container process can basically create process your full trust stuff, right? Your desktop process. And your desktop process can also turn around and activate the code that you'd run in the app container. And on top of that, we give you a communication mechanism. Now, we could have invented a new one. I mean, we are Microsoft. That's kind of our move. But it turned out we already had this thing called App Services that we introduced, a little over a year ago. And we decided to just reuse that. And so basically, the way that it works is your app container process publishes an app service that your desktop process can connect to. And at that point, they can have a bidirectional communication. And so we should take a look, and let's actually just look at the code and see what it looks like. All right, so here we have a classic desktop app that we've now added some UWP code to. And so we basically have an app service, and we actually have a full app. This particular one, we're actually going to show you that neither side of the UI has to be dominant, right? So one thing you can do is you can actually say, I'm going to start moving my UI over to UWP and XAML. And still, even then, you can keep calling out to your desktop app, so it doesn't matter. So here, Payman's going to go ahead and launch it and pin it. So what just happened there when he clicked that launch desktop process is just that. He basically create processed it. And now what he's going to do is show what it looks like to send a request over and get the results back, right? And so that's just our standard app service code. If you've written an app service yet, you know how to write the code. You shouldn't have to learn anything new. And like that is the way that you can start bridging. Because if you think about it, what's happening is, as we said, it's a bridge. You want to get all your code into the right side, right? You want to get your code into the UWP. But all your code is currently on the left side, right? It's in the centennial process. So as you start moving the code, you may find that you have existing Win32 or .NET or COM code that is doing stuff that currently doesn't work in the MSDK. For starters, you can just leave it like that. But I do want to point out one thing, is in Win8, we started off and we said basically there were these like 490,000 Win32 APIs, or Win32 and COM APIs. And we said you could use about that many of them, right? Remember I said we were being stupid? We were being stupid. So what ended up happening was almost all of your code would no longer work. And to be very, very like honest with you, it's not because the code wouldn't have actually worked. It's because people believe, a lot of people believe so much in the new, easier to use API surface that they figured it was, getting you to use the new code, you'd have a more reliable, app, blah 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 blah. Insert justification here. But it turns out there's really nothing easier than not having to change your code at all. And so what we've been doing, and we've already started this and we're continuing to do it, is we're combing through that huge API surface and we're going out and collecting all the data we can and we're making as many of them as we can available. Now, it's not as easy as it sounds. Like, we could just say add it to the SDK and be done, but we first have to go test them all. We have to make sure that they work, right? We have to make sure that they're desirable. I mean, there are actually certain APIs that we built that we probably shouldn't have. If you think about the transaction APIs we built for the registry and file system, like it was great on paper. It turns out that it didn't work out as well as we had hoped. And it turns out if you're using those APIs, your app is probably in danger. And interestingly enough, it's not even the OS's fault. I would like to point out it's not that we wrote buggy code. The teams that wrote that code were extremely careful. They took their job very seriously. And then there was these hardware vendors out there that decided that they could use cheaper parts if only they could lie to the OS. So there's hardware out there that actually lies to the operating system and claims that things are on disk and they're all set, and they're really not on disk. So we have all these kinds of APIs, and so we don't want to put those ones in because we know if you're using them, it's actively dangerous. Then there's all the other APIs that are really great that we want to add. And so we're working on that. It's just going to take some time. But you can expect over time the MSDK surface area to keep growing and growing and growing, not just with new APIs, but adding back all the stuff that we had left out earlier. So as you're thinking about, hey, how much of my code is going to have to stay on the left side and how much can I move to the right side, our goal is most of it you should just be able to move from the left side to the right side wholesale. You shouldn't have to go and rewrite everything in some Windows.networking.blah-blah-blah API. You know, if you use WinSock, great. Use WinSock. We don't care. Yes, third-party components as well. That's actually a key point. One of the other things that someone just said, third-party components. Sometimes, even if you're all in, you're like, you know what? I really want to get on HoloLens, I want to get an Xbox, I want to get an IoT, whatever. Just tell me what code to change and I'll go change it. And then we say, great, this is what you can't do, and you go, crap. I have some third-party component that I bought. I don't have the source code, I can't change the source code. Well, then you really have no choice. You're basically screwed, right? And so that's why, it's another great reason why we're adding all these APIs back. All right, so now you've got this model so far where now you have two processes and they're communicating between each other for cases where they need to. And then over time, you should just start moving more and more of your code into the UWP side, right? Into the app container code. And the main reason that you want to do this is because when you're done, well, first of all, you're back to one process, right? So is it easier to have two processes and have them constantly talking to each other? Or is it easier to just have one process and all the code running together? Like, one process is obviously easier. But more importantly, once you get to that milestone, you're over the bridge. You're now a full-on UWP that should be supported on any Microsoft platform, and you know, anywhere, Xbox, anything. And basically what happened is you just came off of Centennial altogether. You know, I'd like to tell this team, I say, success for Centennial is you put yourself out of business, right? Which sounds kind of awful, but at the same time, they believe me and they bought it. I don't know why, but anyways. So they, like, seriously, within the team, the goal is do everything we can to make it as easy as possible to get over the bridge and get there, because once you're on that platform, you can go everywhere. Because I think it was probably obvious, but I didn't say it. While you're leveraging the Centennial components, those Centennial extension points basically in your app will not work on any other platform. But I've said the phrase Centennial app a few times, and probably the people in the third row are freaking out right now because I actually don't allow them to say that phrase. I never let anyone say Centennial app because there's actually no such thing as a Centennial app. There's only a UWA that leverages Centennial extension points. And so, basically, you can, and we actually do have, we've been working with a lot of companies right now. Evernote, as you can see, was one of them. That's why they were on stage. We've been working with a lot of other really great companies. And we even have some of them. Their plan is they're going to have a single app X. It's going to install everywhere. It's going to work on Xbox. It's going to work on HoloLens. And inside of it, it will also have some Centennial extension points. When you install that app X on desktop, those Centennial extension points will light up, and there'll be some additional functionality that lights up on desktop that just doesn't light up on any other platforms. That's perfectly allowed, right? And that's actually what we would expect and hope that lots of people do. And so now, do you call that a Centennial app? You better not, that's a four-letter word. That's just a UWP app that happens to leverage some Centennial technology on desktop. So the final step, you end up with the full UWP, and at that point, you can see Centennial's not in the picture anymore. So let's go ahead and take the app that we wrote, and let's see what it would look like to convert to Centennial. Let me go over to 8. All right, so basically, you could say this app's a little bit contrived, right? Because your app probably calls lots and lots and lots of APIs that you know, things like the registry is an example of something that we let out into the world and we probably shouldn't have. There are some very useful things you can do with registry APIs, and there's also lots and lots of awful things you can do with registry APIs. And so we realize in hindsight that's probably not something we want to put into UWP. But on the other hand, if you were building a Win32 app or a desktop app, we told you to use the registry API, so you probably did. And so we have an app here that was originally using the registry APIs to store some data. And so the little ping pong thing where it's calling out to the full trust thing, you could start by saying, okay, I'm going to keep all my registry code, and I'm going to run that in the full trust desktop app or desktop process. And anytime I need any of that, I'll send a request over to get the data. And obviously, I'll cache it, so that perf's not bad. Well, as you start doing that, you may eventually say, hey, we do have new APIs. They're basically like the registry APIs, except they're a lot easier to use, and they store their information in a separate hive so that you don't end up cluttering the computer's registry or your system's registry. And so basically what Payman's doing is just taking that code and replacing the registry code with code that calls the new settings APIs. And the moment that you do that, the calls that I had to make to the desktop process, they're no longer necessary. And so you end up in a world where now that that's code is running in process, if I don't need that desktop process anymore, now I can kill it. You got all through? Cool. Applause for Payman for not getting fired today. Thanks, man. All right. Yes, I left a lot of time for questions. Let's get through the demo. I clicked. Here we go. All right. So, but before I start accepting questions, I just want to talk a little bit about what we have. So a year ago, we told you to sign up for, there was an option to sign up for like a Centennial group and we'd give you information. And then we gave you almost no information. I inquired about this. Apparently, when we did that, legally, we were only supposed to ever be able to send you like something like 3 emails. But with you signing up for that, we could send you almost no communication. So we were actually, people were intentionally not sending it because they were trying to wait for the right thing. But we have a new site up where you can go get tons of information about Centennial. We created a short link for it. It's akams/desktopbridge. And on top of that, one of the best things that you can do is go up to the third floor of this building and bring your installer. And if you don't have your installer, try to go get it. And if you can't get it or whatever, feel free to come up anyway and ask questions. You'll have the team of people that built this technology sitting up there. So it's like no better time to get all your questions answered. There's an Ask the Experts area, apparently. I now know that. And so I guess we'll be there, too. Does anyone know where the Ask the Experts? That's where it is. It's at the hub at the Universal Windows platform station. Great. One other point, by the way. We just gave you, or I think we're giving you, a build of Windows as part of this wonderful conference. Centennial's not enabled in it. Sorry. Did I say it was a small group of people? They worked their hearts out, and it turned out that we were trying to get to platform complete so we can actually ship. And shipping took precedence over, you know, rushing to get everything into the build. But we should have a new, you know, insider preview build coming out soon. The bits will be live in that. So if you're not a Windows insider, first of all, why? But you won't get the bits unless you do. So if you're signed up for Windows Insider, the next one that comes out after the build conference should have all the bits in it, which means any of the things that you bring and have us convert for you, you can try it there, I believe, right? We have a thing to try. Okay, so in the booth, you'll be able to try it with a build that we have that has Centennial enabled. Once the Insider build comes out, then you can go ahead and try it on your own. That's right. One other thing is there's going to be people stationed outside of the room as you're leaving, and there's going to be a flash voting session, and apparently they're going to ask you some questions, and there's a few other places you can go give us feedback. That's it. Make sure to fill out your evaluation forms. If I offended you, I apologize now, so don't give me a bad score because of that. All right, time for questions. Can we maybe bring the lights up? And there's actually microphones here. It's better to use the microphone because they're recording this. And the people would be able to hear your question. And by the way, hey, Payman, for the first two gentlemen in line, these are $25 Windows gift cards. You give it to the one on each side. All right, good.
Last year when I talked to you, you had mentioned that there's a bunch of APIs that you didn't foresee that would ever get whitelisted, especially amongst like the kernel API calls. Is that still the case, or can you give us a little bit more clear idea what will never make a Centennial app, quote?
Well, so it's not APIs. So one thing about Centennial is your app's only going to run as the user. And we do that for really good reasons. When I talked about there's lots of things you can do with your desktop app, some which are pretty good and some which aren't so good. When it comes to things that are people are going to go up to the store and get, or they're just going to get by double-clicking on an AppX, we really want those to be secure. And so you run just as the user like you always did, but you can't install NT services. We don't support NT services as part of Centennial Apps, and we don't support drivers. So if you think about it, as long as your code's running as the user, you're good. If for some reason you were trying to run as some other user or trying to always have to elevate, you're not a great candidate for Centennial. This is not the last version ever. We figured out that if we built all the features in one release, we'd be out of a job. So we figured we better hold back, and so we're building some of the features now. We are looking to add more later, and those will be coming in a different release of Windows, not the anniversary edition or whatever.
So we've been lucky enough in our organization, or we thought we were being clever or whatever, to manage to get virtually all of our Windows enterprise applications into ClickOnce. Mm-hmm. So I've got a couple of questions about ClickOnce. First off, will Centennial help me to migrate my ClickOnce apps, or is there even a necessity to? And secondly, is there a compelling reason to?
The first one being, yes, it should be able to help you migrate your ClickOnce apps. It turns out that the ClickOnce installer does some pretty funky things, and I know that the team that's building the converter is looking at what's the best way to defunkify that, to convert it over so that it'll work well. The biggest benefits is actually that, by getting over to AppX, you get better install technology, and also it can be supported by more of the deployment systems out there. Because, if your enterprise, SCCM and all those things already support that, and if you want the ClickOnce experience, we really showed you double-clicking on an AppX file, but that's not all you can do. You can drop an AppX file up on a website and have someone click a link and have that same install experience.
Right, but presumably until we move to some kind of Windows 10 environment, we're still presently at Windows 7 in the enterprise.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Until we move to Windows 10, there arguably isn't a compelling reason apart from the few users that are actually using it.
Yeah, if that's your business need for now, there's no reason you can't stay on whatever install tech you have so far. We are seeing, actually, I spent most of my career in the enterprise side of the house. I've only been in the core platform side for about 6 years now. And the uptake of Windows 10 in the enterprise has actually blown me away. It's the rate at which people are trying to adopt it is really high. But yeah, that's one of the things about Centennial is we want your existing code to keep working. Yep. So you can.
Thanks. I have a couple questions. First was, I was a little confused about how you were describing using this Centennial app as a way to access things that you couldn't in just a plain UWA. So let's say I have a UWA and I have this secondary app that does things,
It's one app,
okay.
Right? So everything's contained inside a single AppX. All it is that there are multiple processes, right? One of the processes can be running in the app container, can be doing XAML and all those kind of things. The other process can be your desktop code running as it always did. And that's that communication channel.
So it's just one submission to store,
Just one submission to the store. It's just it's a single app that just has a bunch of different pieces in it.
To follow up on that, you mentioned that you need the newer version of Windows to be able to run that type of app.
Yep.
Does that mean that for example, if we added new features and not everybody's on the newer version, we'd have to either wait for them to upgrade or we'd have to have some kind of split thing where some people. We have to have a submission for people who are not on the latest version of Windows.
Yeah, that's the whole purpose of Centennial is that you can still keep supporting Windows 7. Like I said, that's why really the best experience that we've seen is with either Install Shield or Wix. And by the way, there are other installation technologies out there, and they may also support this model. But we've been working with FireGiant and with Install Shield so far, and basically. The model where that's your installer generator, and it can either spit out an MSI or a Centennial app is kind of the best world because it just means as part of your build process you can spit out both every day. It's one code base and it can even be a single binary. You don't have to recompile it twice or anything. But yeah, if someone's running Windows 7, they can't leverage Centennial.
Well, actually, I was asking about Windows 10 because what we find is a lot of people are still on pre-November update Windows. So it's like the adoption rate is always not, you know, immediate for those people to get on the latest update of Windows.
Yeah. Well, that was certainly true for previous versions of Windows. The data that we're getting in, for Windows 10 is that when we release stuff, if you're already on Windows 10, we make it a recommended update and it just goes. But yes, they will need to be on the anniversary edition.
But you think it's safe to be able to target the newer version and, you know?
I put it this way, if we don't get people updating to the anniversary edition, then some very powerful people at Microsoft will get fired. So I think we'll succeed.
Okay. Last question was, as far as some of the, like the I/O redirection and stuff like that,
uh-huh.
Do you do that for everything? Like, for example, if an app is looking for files in your document, like, you know, previously we...
That's why I said it's only the app data folder, the folder that's hidden to users. If your app writes stuff anywhere else on the system, it's just there. Which means when we uninstall, we don't clean that stuff up. So if your app generates documents in My Documents, it goes to the real My Documents, nothing gets in the way, and it remains.
And you'll be able to like do searches and look for files?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, your code will work just as always. That's why I want to point out, people keep thinking that like the dreaded V word, virtualization. They're like, is this a virtualization technology? And it's like, no, it's a don't rewrite your code technology.
Okay. One more. Do you do any kind of improvements just running through the that converter? Like there's a problem of older apps not adapting to the DPIs correctly on like high resolution.
No, there's nothing we can do. That takes real code.
Right. Thank you.
Hi. Yes, I was wondering if my company ships two products that are shipped separately, but they sometimes share data and app data. Is there a way to have a common container that my enterprise or my...
Yes. So basically, UWAs, they already have the concept of a publisher folder. And because you're a UWA that happens to leverage the Centennial extensions, you get a publisher folder. So yes, we give you a folder and we give you an API to get at that folder.
So the legacy desktop apps could share the same data?
Yeah, because they're at this point now, they aren't legacy desktop apps. They are modern desktop apps or whatever. And so yes, they get access to that.
Thanks.
Does that same thing apply to multiple executables that communicate to each other through COM or through the registry? Like if we have a suite that installs 40 or 50 executables and they all want to share data through, you know, various mechanisms or launch each other, will this deal with that?
First of all, please stop using the registry as a communication mechanism, right? Remember when I said we allowed you to do things that might be dumb? That's dumb.
Yep.
So please don't do that, and we will get in your way, and I'm going to go to sleep every night being really happy that I got in your way, because it's going to make you change that code. But in general, we shouldn't get in the way of any of the other communication mechanisms.
So they'll all run in the same container?
You can run them all in the same container. So one thing you can do, I mean, that's really more of an enterprise scenario. You can actually, if your installer might install 50 apps, right? Then yes, those can all end up in a single AppX. Now, I'm fairly certain the store would not accept that because the store doesn't accept a single app that's actually a bunch of apps just because it's one of those awful user experiences where it's like, I really want A. And it's like, congratulations, you just got A, B, C, D, and E. And then the user's like, but I don't want B, C, D, and E. And as it tries to uninstall them, it uninstalls A. Like in the store, that's not a great experience. But for enterprises, it's very common. And yes, in Centennial is just UWA, and so you can have multiple apps inside of it. They'll all run in one container. Unfortunately, the registry hack will still work, but at least you're not in the real registry anymore. And so, yeah.
Cool, thanks.
Okay, remember all that thing, everything that I said about third floor? Just select, cut, and paste in first floor, what is it called? The hub. I guess we moved all that stuff down to the hub now, so that's where we'll be. All right, I forget which side I was on.
How you doing, John? First of all, I want to say this is really cool tech, man. It's like almost like the modern API, the WinRT API that was introduced in Windows 8 kind of came full circle, finally. Mm-hmm. So. You know, big props to you guys for doing that. I got a couple of questions. The second one kind of was answered by the other gentleman, but I wanted to ask it anyway. First of all, when you were showing the demo with the desktop app converter and you showed the output folder with all the files, there were some other files besides the appx, like registry.dat and so forth. And I kind of understand what the registry.dat file is, but aren't those files are not included in the appx that's generated? So we still need to include?
They should all be included in the app X that's generated. Yeah. I mean, app X, there's the manifest file, right, which everyone has. There's a block map in there, which everyone has. What's a block map? I'll tell you later. Doesn't matter. You know, there's certain files that get generated as part of the format. And then we basically add two main things. We add a registry.dat file that's, if you're Visual Studio, that contains like 750,000 registry entries in your own separate dat file, or however many your app did. And then there was also a folder in there called VFS. Under there is where we put things that, say, you installed into System32. We put them inside of there just so that we can set up mapping so that your code can work.
Yeah, all the faking that you were talking about earlier.
Yeah, okay. It's called lying. It's lies.
Right, that's right. But it works. Hey, that's awesome, though. That's fantastic. So second question really quickly, I know a lot of people, is that relating to when you mentioned the word app container, I'm a little confused because at the very beginning you said that it creates a desktop app container, that it's not a sandbox, and it has all these faking tricks you guys do.
Yeah.
That's different, of course, from the universal app container.
Right.
So maybe you could just clarify that a little bit.
Yeah, so the universal app container is the thing that if you build a regular, ordinary UWA, XAML app or whatever, we run you inside of an app container to prevent the app from harming the system and harming the user, right? And so it gives us the ability to specify capabilities where we can give you controlled access to the rest of the system. That's what we just call app container. The desktop app container thing and, like, you know, we just picked that name because why not? I think it was Thursday. And so that one, basically, its purpose isn't to protect the system, right? Its purpose is to just make your code work. So yes, they have similar sounding names, but they have very different purposes.
Thank you very much.
Yep.
So let's say we have a two process package. One is a daemon, and one is a UI component. And the daemon is supposed to run in the background. How does that work with this model?
So it works just like it does. So today you would use one of the standard, like either the startup folder, or you would use the run key in the registry, or you'd use whatever. We have one of the extensions that exists in the manifest is basically run me when the user logs in. And so your daemon would basically be registered there. I don't know if the converter does it yet, but what the converter should do for you is if we see you put something in the run key or we see you put it in the startup folder, we should automatically generate that for you, which means when I install the app, that thing will start running. Separately, when the user launches the UI, then it will start up and connect to that.
And then you also mentioned about privilege access not is frowned upon. How about apps that are... they have the UI access declared in the manifest.
We definitely don't support UI access, because UI access, basically, its purpose is to do anything.
Yeah, pretty
right?
much.
Right? And so almost, because it can do almost. Absolutely anything, basically anything, we don't support it today. But again, like I said, we will build more features so they don't fire us. And so we already have talked to people about UI access.
Are you going to package Visual Studio and Apex so we don't deal with the 750,000? No.
We've talked to the Visual Studio team. We'll see.
The desktop app, can that talk to SQL Server?
Yeah.
You mentioned drivers. Any problems?
It can talk to any drivers. What your Apex can't do is your Apex can't install the driver. But if the driver's there, and your code normally talks to it, it's still going to talk to it the way it always did.
Thank you.
Yep.
So can these apps be submitted to the store?
Yes.
Okay.
So but what I want to say is, like, right now, put it this way, right now, zero apps that are from the anniversary, that take advantage of the anniversary edition features or whatever, can be submitted to the store. The one thing we are talking about in working with the store team is the store team owns their own onboarding process. And as we just said, these apps are really, really privileged.
Right.
And so the store team's going to need to figure out how they do their onboarding so users don't get hurt. It's going to take time, like, to be very fair. Right now, we know nothing, so we're basically stupid about this. And we're going to learn, and we'll get better. And as we do, we'll be able to onboard more and more apps. But the onboarding for a Centennial app is harder for us.
Okay. Yeah, that was my question.
Hey, pardon if you've already answered this or implied an answer, but we have a scenario where we're using MAF with process isolation. So at startup, Microsoft Application Framework, you know, where you start it up, it's plug-in architecture.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
So we have that. Is that going to be able to support that kind of scenario?
Yeah, it should. There shouldn't be any reason why. I'd have to look at the details. I'm not sure. I can tell you right now, we haven't tried a math app.
Hey, we have one.
You know, I hear a rumor that there's a booth you can go to.
Yeah, I heard that.
So I'd recommend you should go there.
Oh, well, one more, sorry. Yeah. So with that, is there the capability of talking to an application that is not wrapped?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, you can talk to them. And anything that's anything else that's on the system, you should have complete unfettered communication with.
Thank you.
I think one more. I think I'm out of time, but one more.
How does Centennial handle loading DLLs that are already installed in the GAC and NGen, just sort of generally NGen?
So, things that are already in the GAC should just work fine because you're just installed on the system. Right now, we don't support NGen today, and we work very closely with the .NET team. And so for Centennial V1, we went back and forth, and we decided not to support NGen today. But we do hope to support it in the future. If you have components you install in the GAC, you will see those components, but no one else on the system would see those components. So if your purpose of putting stuff was in the GAC, which, by the way, I found out from the .NET team, almost everyone that puts stuff in the GAC is for their own use, which kind of makes no sense because it's called global. But if you are doing that, that doesn't work with Centennial right now. That is another example of something we're looking at for V2. All right, one more question, and then.
Is this going to work with Silverlight apps at all?
Sure, as long as the Silverlight apps are like, did they work before?
I did not write them. I'm asking for one of my friends.
If they worked before, they should, and I use the should word because you always have to try, they should work after. Again, I'd recommend there's a booth, go to the booth, blah, blah, blah. Great. All right, that's it. Thanks, everybody.